Hey everyone, welcome to the 59th episode of Baseline Intelligence, the podcast designed to make you a better tennis player and a smarter athlete. I'm your host, Jonathan Stokey. Today's guest is Gabby Dabrowski. Gabby is the reigning U.S. Open women's doubles champion and is also a two-time mixed doubles Grand Slam champion. On today's episode, we discuss your doubles return options, how to hit better overheads, and the best coaching advice she's ever received. So sit back, relax, and prepare to become a smarter tennis player. All right, Gabby, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're the third member of the very successful Routliff Dabrowski doubles team. I had Aaron on kind of the beginning of November. I just interviewed Dan a week ago. I don't know when I'll release the episode. And now you're on. So no pressure because they were both awesome guests.
Oh, I'm sure they were. No, I have big shoes to fill. Okay, let's go.
So I was looking you up and researching your history and just kind of getting your tennis background. And I didn't realize you had won two mixed Grand Slam titles in, I believe, 2017 at the French and 2018 at the Australian Open. So one question I had is just even at the pro level, does your game change at all when it's mixed versus women's doubles?
Actually, yes, a little bit. I tend to play better in mixed doubles, or I have played better in mixed doubles. And I think that's because everything happens extremely fast and I have absolutely no time to think. So everything that's like instinctual just takes over, and I've had success playing in that way. And I've actually tried to emulate that mindset in women's doubles in the last couple of years, where I go into women's doubles thinking it's mixed doubles. And sometimes that helps me just kind of keep a very clear picture of what I want to do, because there's literally no room for error. And in mixed doubles in those years, it really helped bring the best tennis out of me. So yeah, there is a little bit of a difference, but I think I'm getting the hang of women's doubles now.
I was going to say, you've been doing pretty well lately. That's for sure. So one thing, when the man is serving against you, whoever the ATP pro is, I'm sure that's significantly quicker than what you're used to on the women's tour. Is there anything that you do with your return that you kind of use to adjust to that speed or to that quality of ball on their serve?
Yeah, it depends who is serving and how they serve, because there are some guys who kick their serves a lot. And then others who hit a little bit more powerfully through the court. And then there's some who obviously can just do everything and you're kind of stuck. But when I'm playing someone who has kicked their serves a lot, I either try to move really far in to try to take the ball on the rise so it doesn't get above my shoulders, or I've actually moved really far back to make sure I get a hit on it and just lob it in the air just to start the point. Because at least on my return, returning the guy's serve, if I just start the point, that usually puts us in a better position than if they're just acing me left and right. And then sometimes I can get a read on the guy's serve depending on their toss. And if I know a little bit about them, or if like my partner's told them some of, or if my partner's told me some of their tendencies. So sometimes I can cheat a little bit and guess. And then if I connect, that's actually the most satisfying thing, I think, in tennis for me. Is connecting on the guy's serve and having the ball come back to them faster than it came at me. But yeah, so it's usually just a little bit of an adjustment of the positioning and then hopefully reading their toss or knowing their patterns a little bit.
When you were talking about attacking the kick serve, do you actually just start closer, or is it like once they toss, you kind of move forward after the toss?
Both. It depends. I tend to vary it. I try to not stay in the same position too much if I am trying to cheat, because I don't want them to also see that I'm starting really far in and then blast a body serve at me and I can't get out of the way. So I'll kind of do what I can in the moment, but yeah, I'll try to mix it up.
And you mentioned staying back, letting the ball drop and possibly like lobbing a return. So that's something I always get from adults, is like people hate when other people lob, mainly because they don't have overheads and they don't like covering the net. But what is your thought? Like when you're hitting that lob return, is there a certain target or a trajectory? Like, is that just a feel thing that you have from experience? Cause I watched you play in Cancun and you do have like a great lob. What is your thought on the lob?
Usually if it's a return, I'm going for height. And then hopefully that translates into depth. I've noticed if I hit the lob a little bit too low, it's tougher to control the depth and they can land quite short. It's a little bit different when it's very, very windy, because then you need to kind of lower the trajectory to control the ball a little bit more. But I would say in a general sense, I just try to get it up really high. And then that also gives time for my partner to notice that I've lobbed, and for him to take, or even for Aaron in women's doubles to take the position they want to take. You know, if the lob's really good, maybe they don't go too far back. But if it's maybe sort of just past the service line, then maybe we've taken a defensive position back and it gives us time to play that defense better.
And then what about when you're ripping a return? Do you have any, like, one coach kind of told me when I'm hitting cross court, I should aim at that side tee, which is like the single sideline and the service line where they meet as a cross court. Like, that was a very specific target. Of course, I was super stubborn, so I didn't do it. But like, he had a very specific area where, like, that's where he said you go cross court. And then when you go down the line, you aim for the single sideline. Do you have anything like that? Or is it just kind of, I'm going cross, I'm going line, I can see where their net player is and just kind of see the specific angle against that particular opponent?
In an ideal world, yes, I have a target and I stick to it and I'm committed. It could be the target that other player said. I like that T target in doubles, because that means it's low and it's angled. So it's not like in doubles, when you play proper doubles, some of the worst shots you can hit are just down the middle or in sort of that middle third of the court-ish. So I find when you have a target that's a little bit more to the side, whatever that may be, it could be the single sideline, could be that tee. It could be also the net tape. That's a target that I like to pick a lot. And then it, not that it doesn't matter where I'm hitting, but at least if I'm hitting it very low over the net, the accuracy doesn't matter quite as much because it's really difficult to put away that volley. So I would have then maybe a general area, but then the net tape. Or sometimes the center strap, depending on who you're playing. Maybe there are players that don't take the middle as well and you kind of have that gap, then the center strap could be a good one too.
One of my best doubles partners at Duke, he was such a great returner and he would always aim strap, but he was also kind of saying, like, by the way, he's like, I don't hit it exactly over the strap just because I'm aiming there. So he's like, sometimes I actually hit it. Ready. Yeah, you're like, you hit it better cross court than you expected, or
right.
Even if it goes over there, like if the person does a bad backhand volley and you're in the ad court, well, they're not going to poach, so it's all good.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you find, by the way, do you find that when you're playing, generally speaking, is there a stronger volley that you would say, like, on the women's tour, like most girls have a better forehand or most girls have a better backhand? Because that's definitely something at the amateur level where people are like, I don't want to poach with my backhand volley. That's something I hear a lot. Do you see patterns with that?
Yeah, I think in general, for the women, just because naturally our wrist strength is not quite as good in that sort of cocked position for the backhand volley, I would say the forehand volley is normally stronger. That's actually why I think when I was younger, I ended up hitting a lot of two-handed volleys, because I realized that my strength, I could hit a one-handed volley, but to put away the ball and have more power on my shot, I did better with two hands. So now I hit a lot of two-handed backhand volleys, almost with a bit of topspin, or oftentimes with topspin. Jury's out on whether people like that or not, but I find it really works for me. And obviously I've been doing it for many years, so it's not too difficult to time. There are moments in matches where I mistime it, but what I like about it is usually once I've hit it, the point is over or almost over, because the quality of my volley is quite strong. But Dan is getting me to be a little bit more disciplined, and a few of my other coaches to take, you know, the left hand off and to keep my racket in front, just so I have more variation. My first volley is almost always one-handed, but after that, the closer I get to the net, I tend to put that left hand back on. But that is something that I wonder with recreational players, how comfortable they would feel with having a two-handed backhand volley, especially for the women, instead of just one. Maybe they would also feel like they have a little more control and a little more power.
I definitely agree with that. And by the way, like, this is just one member of the jury, but I like the two-hander for you.
Cool, thanks.
that's my one vote in the jury room. So something Erin and I were talking about was her net play. And she made the comment, I'm getting better at the net, but I'm nowhere near as good as Gabby. So I'm curious. There's lots of things that go into being a good net player, like volley technique, kind of reading your opponent and where the ball is going to be, your footwork. Between those three types of, like, what is the most important thing for you when you're trying to be good at the net? Is it just practicing volley technique? Is it knowing what's coming? Or is it kind of the footwork aspect?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it also really depends on the type of ball coming to you. I think one thing for us that's really important is positioning. So when we're able to get, you know, pretty close to the net and finish with our noses on the net, usually, you know, we've won a lot of those matches. And then once you're in a really good position, then now we're working on angling off our volleys to finish that point, keeping our hands in front to even sometimes if you catch the frame, if your racket's in front of you, good things happen. When your racket's behind you, bad things happen. And so we're getting a lot better, I think, at keeping our elbows in front, keeping our racket in front. And of course, over months of practice and playing lots of matches, you get to read people and you understand their patterns. But I would say that that's probably the last thing that's important. If you're in the right position, if your technique is good, learning the patterns will come just by playing a lot. But reading patterns and having bad technique or bad positioning doesn't necessarily help you to finish the points in an aggressive way. You may know what's going on, but if you don't have the ability to finish the point, it doesn't really matter. That would be my point of view.
Tell me if you've ever done this one. I had a coach, you know, speaking about your elbows in front. So he would have me get right on the net, put my elbows over the net, and then he would fire balls at me because then I could never take my elbow back.
So yeah.
Have you done that one before?
No. Well, a little bit, but Erin did that drill with Dan, I think, in Cincinnati. And I think it was the first time she'd ever done that drill before. So that's pretty impressive that at that point in her tennis career, she hadn't done that drill before. And you can maybe fact check that with her. So I'm not speaking out of turn, but for me, it's a little bit different because when I was growing up in Canada, obviously the weather was tough and we didn't have a ton of indoor court time. So I played a lot in my basement and our ceilings were really low and the wall was probably, I don't know, maybe 15, max 20 feet away from me. And my dad actually built like this wooden board over the wall and then he put up a curtain. So we had the wall protected, then the balls wouldn't come back at me and he installed the ball machine in the corner of the basement and I was on the other side and we put up a little net in the middle and the ball machine would fire balls at me and I'm like 9, 10, 11 years old. So I don't really remember what I was doing then, but I think it helped with my hand-eye coordination and just naturally needing to protect myself from the speed of the ball that was, you know, coming. So I think I maybe lucked out with those drills very, very early on in my tennis. But I do think that that's a great drill because I actually do a drill similar to that for my return, which is when you stand in front of the fence, someone hits the ball to you and you keep your racket in front of you. The racket can't hit the fence. Obviously, it's very exaggerated. But for me, for a long time, I've always wanted to swing really big. So having that compact stroke has been really helpful on the return, which it's kind of the same with the elbows over the net. Like everything is staying kind of in front of you and in your peripheries, I guess, and in front of them.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you do better when you and Erin both get very tight to the net, right? Mm. Is there a visual cue from your opponent that allows you to feel comfortable? Like, when is it time to close and when is it time to not get 6 inches from the net? Is there anything you're looking at on the other side of the court?
A little bit. The type of ball. Usually we look at the quality of the ball. So if we've not hit maybe the greatest quality of ball, then it's a little bit difficult to close the net consistently. Sometimes I still like to because I just try to trust my reflexes that I'm going to be in a better position closer than I am further back. But I feel like in that sense, if we haven't hit the best quality of ball and we're maybe at the net, but in a little bit of defense, that we still make sure our momentum is forward. So we're not moving backwards as the ball is coming to us. We may move back for a second to be like, uh-oh, but then when they hit, we move back forward so that if we do make contact with the ball, we still get something on it. Otherwise, it's really hard to kind of control, I think, your racket and your body weight if you're leaning back. So that would just be one thing if the quality of the ball is not amazing. The other thing is if the quality of the ball is great, then it gives us a few more options on how we want to close. And then you can get into close lag, like the stagger of who's closing when and how much. And, you know, if Erin is closing in, maybe I'm taking a slightly more neutral position because I see that she's closing and then I have to be kind of the person that covers the lob and vice versa. Because I think when someone is closing the net, you don't want to stop them. I see a lot at the recreational level, a lot of players get to just inside the service line and stop. And they're both players are in the same place and neither person knows who's covering the lob. So when you train the close lag structure, then it becomes more clear on who's covering the lob. And if the lob is on the baseline and is perfect, that's fine. But that's a really hard shot to hit over and over again, especially if the quality of the volley or the approach shot is very good. So it's kind of like a long-winded answer, but there's not really one exact answer to, you know, how we read the game.
Can you explain it to me one more time? So, because that's something I always did instinctively, and maybe that's what you're referring to, but like, let's say I was in juniors playing with Rajiv and we're at the net and I can just feel him closing.
Yeah.
Then I'm just instinctively going, well, one of us has to cover the lob and we both.
Yeah.
So is it just instinctual, or are there actual rules for that close lagging that you're talking about?
Some people it might be instinctual, but you can train it within a structure. You can create a rule or at least mostly a guideline, because obviously things happen in matches and it might not be exact, but it gives a good guideline of who then should cover the lob. For me, again, once my partners, I see them hit one volley, a second volley, I'm like, great, they're all over it. I'm going to become a little more neutral, but that doesn't mean I back up too much. I might back up one step and just read the play from there. It just means that I'm not closing with her.
Yeah.
And so we're both our noses are not completely on top of the net. Like, that's why I think great doubles teams, you kind of see them moving in cohesion with each other. And there's a bit of a flow. Yeah. And that's one thing. It's funny because I don't think that a lot of the commentators commentating our matches, men's and women's, they don't necessarily highlight that aspect of it, but it is something that we work on and that we train.
For sure. So Erin tells me then that this year she's going to be getting closer to the net. That's one thing she said. She said, I'm still working on it, which means you will be having to protect against the lob a little bit. Do you have any good technical advice out there for a listener on like your overhead or how to hit a better overhead?
Yeah, two things. One, something that I will be working on this preseason is my first step. So I think if you get a quick first step back, how you want to train that will depend on your level and your abilities and all that stuff. But for me, it'll be like a push off my left combined with a push of my right to get back, and then a shoulder turn. I think it's really important to be sideways. Sometimes I don't do it and I tend to miss those overheads. But if I get back quickly and I'm sideways, then I have options of where I can hit and how. But if you're don't shuffle backwards with your chest forward. Basically, just try not to do that.
Yeah, that is great advice. Yeah, everyone, the two things that are so common when you're uncomfortable in tennis is you want to face the ball and you want to get close to the ball. You want to control everything, and you know, turning away might feel unnatural, but that's great advice. I love that. Okay, so communication. This is something Dan talked about big time. I'm going to come at it from a different angle because he's already, you know, done a lot in terms of explaining what you guys do. But in between points, I'm curious, like sometimes when I was at the Open this year, I'm watching doubles teams and some of them look like they're barely talking in between points. And some of them look like they're, you know, a whole chapter of a book, like what they're going to do. What is it that you like, do you guys just have a simple thing? Hey, serve here, we're covering this. Or are you talking about, I notice this girl struggling on this return, and you kind of talk through a target. Like, what does it look like when you're in between points on a service game?
It can be a little bit of both. It depends on at which point we're at in the match. Probably earlier in the match, the chat is not as long because we're still maybe sticking to our patterns and our game plan. And then after that, we'll be assessing if we need to make any adjustments, which is when those longer conversations can happen of, you know, if I'm at the net and Erin is serving, sometimes I notice things that she may not notice because I can see how the returner feels off of certain serves and I can see her positioning and if it changes as Erin tosses or not, whereas Erin might not see that, and vice versa. Erin may see something at the net that I don't see. I remember a couple times when I took a few returns at the net person, Erin turned to me and said, oh, she did not like that. Like, her eyes went big and she moved backwards. Whereas when I hit the ball, I didn't necessarily notice that. So it was really good feedback for me. So I think it really depends at what point in the match you're at and what you've seen. But I feel like for us, we're kind of constantly assessing, you know, what's working, what's not working, what's missing, trying to keep it, you know, non-judgmental and trying to not be negative and overly emotional about stuff, which is not easy sometimes. So sometimes the conversations are tactical. Sometimes they're a technical reminder to ourselves, because a lot of times I'll just say things out loud of what I'm thinking of for myself. I'll say it to Erin. And sometimes she reminds me of stuff like aim for the tape, you know, little cues. We're very much a team, and it's something that we work on individually and together. You know, we talk about the style of communication the other one likes. It's kind of like a love language. You know, how best do you want to be supported in the difficult moments? And so we've been lucky enough to have those open conversations with each other to get to a point where we can kind of feel what the other person needs in certain moments. And we don't always get it right, and sometimes we get in our own way. But overall, we have like a pretty good commitment, I would say, to supporting each other. And it's been working pretty well so far. So I'm happy about it.
I asked Dan, well, he mentioned it first, but I asked Dan what his non-negotiable rules were for you guys. And he did tell me rule number one on the group chat. I know that one.
Rule number one, unconditional support.
Well, he said it in a much, much more crass way, which I'll probably delete from this podcast. But he said rule number one on your team was don't be a dickhead.
Yeah, it's true. That's rule number one. I didn't know he said it publicly, but yeah, that's literally our rule number one is don't be a dickhead.
That's so funny.
And it's just a simple way of accepting. You just ask yourself, am I being a dickhead? And if the answer is yes, then you have to change something. And also, it's ideal if you apply it to your partner, but also to yourself. Because sometimes it's easy to be really supportive to another person and then be really hard on ourselves. Or for some people, it's vice versa. Maybe they love to blame the other person and they're never hard on themselves. So it's kind of like, don't be a dickhead to yourself or to your partner. You know, be supportive all the time. Because that's, otherwise, your best tennis can't come out consistently. It may once in a while, but not over the course of a long period of time, I think. Absolutely. And that's been a really hard lesson for me to learn both ways. So it's been really good to actually have Dan just come out and say that, because it was a simple way to keep us accountable. You know,
it's pretty tough to argue with that framework where you're like, am I acting like one? And you're like, well, God, I mean, I can't really defend that behavior. And so it's like actually super easy to correct when you frame it that way. One question on returns. Do you guys give signals in between first and second serve return where you're going to go? And sometimes you just pre-planned it and said, hey, we're going line on second serve no matter what.
Yep. Sometimes we do signals. Sometimes we pre-plan. Yeah, I love a plan, but I also love adapting in the moment if necessary. I probably love structure more than Erin does, but I think her talents have become much more dangerous within a type of framework of doubles. And for me, the framework has allowed to keep things more simple. I would say in my head, give me more clarity. So the hand signals kind of go hand in hand with keeping with our game plan of like communicating with each other, talking to each other about what we notice on the other side, reminders to each other if we need them. Yeah, I use them a little bit more sporadically. Erin uses them pretty often, but I mean, I like them. Because also then you kind of maybe also send the message to your opponents that, like, you know, we're thinking, we're in this. We're not just flying by the seat of our pants, but like our points have a purpose.
Tell me if you think this is like amateur hour, if I'm exposing myself as like I'm not on pro level coaching, whatever. But something I used to do as a player was like, let's say my partner had returned cross a couple times in a row and we're moving on it well, and mm-hmm. we want to go cross again. And I was like a little worried that my opponent might poach. Mm-hmm. I might give him a signal and go, I might say it like this. I might go here this time. And I still point cross court. And so I'm hoping the person hears it and kind of is like, well, you said it. Play games like that with people?
Sometimes. Yes.
Love it.
Yep. Love it. Sometimes I haven't said something in a long time and I might make a boring call, like what you just said, like keep doing the same thing. Or I might make a call where like I'm poaching and I haven't poached in a long time. So I definitely agree with you that there are lots of ways to communicate that may or may not seem honest to the other side, but it doesn't really matter.
Exactly. That's their problem. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. We're going to finish up with a couple Instagram questions. The first question from someone was, they want to know what's something you learned over the years that you wish you knew 10 years ago when you started your pro career?
Oh my God, so many things.
I know. They ask one, they ask the best questions. Well, I mean, honestly, give as many as you want.
Okay, one is definitely be kinder to yourself. Definitely. Two would be win the lottery and afford a high-level coach. Because at the time I was still playing singles. And the reason I switched to doubles, which I'm incredibly grateful for, was basically because I ran out of money and I couldn't get any better in singles. And my dad was helping me and I had a few coaches help me here and there, but I couldn't afford anyone like really good full time. So my dad would call it like, we just did the best we could with the information we had and homegrown tennis. So I wish there was a way to have invested a little bit differently in my tennis maybe, but that's not something I could really control. That's just more of a dream. Now that I know what I know about tennis and my game, I wish I would have had the chance, you know, to be 20 again and do a few things over. But the third thing, what would the third thing be?
Kinder to yourself is one that's popped. We've asked this question a couple times and that's
people that, say that
it's happened. A couple people have said that answer and they just said they used to, I think Thomas Johansson earlier this year said he used to just beat the hell out of himself, like after losses. And he's like, I might've only lost by 2 points. And he's like, I couldn't forgive myself for either playing poorly or not coming through. And he said it was just really tough and he wished he could have just been easier on himself.
Then maybe we just leave it at that. Because honestly, for me, there are many times in my tennis career that I've gotten in my own way because I was too hard on myself. On one hand, it motivated me to be better. But on the other hand, there were times where I was limited in what attitude I could bring to the table. And sometimes some matches are won purely on attitude and grit. And when you're a perfectionist, it's only good up until a certain point. Then you got to let some things go. So
here's another tricky one. This person wanted to know, what is the best coaching advice you've ever received?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we take as of late, what's been most helpful is literally don't be a dickhead, because it was the most simple way to say, don't get in your own way. Don't get in the way of your partner with your attitude. Support each other as best as you possibly can, and you'll give yourselves the best chance to win that match. But in a general sense, the most important thing I've ever learned, it actually came from a life coach, not a tennis coach. And that was, you are not your mind, which is, we have many thoughts, some of which are helpful, some of which are unhelpful, but they are not all true. And so the only time that you can really be affected by a thought is when you attach meaning to it and you accept it as absolute truth. So better be careful what you're accepting as absolute truth, because a lot of the times it is false. And we have a lot of biases and preconceived notions about things. So always learn to question your thoughts, because you are not your mind.
The second part of that answer was much deeper than the first part. By the way, if I start selling t-shirts with like my baseline intelligence, like don't be a dickhead might be like one of the first phrases that I put on it, but I love this.
You do that and Dan gets a royalty.
I love it. Okay, next question. What is something amateurs don't know or don't understand about pro doubles?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to know what they assume, but it also really depends on the type of doubles team you are, because there are predominantly singles doubles teams and there are predominantly doubles teams. There are some that are a mix of both. So I think that's like highly, highly subjective. One thing I would say is probably just the amount of effort that predominantly doubles teams put into tactics and strategy and their homework and scouting, and that our training is tailored to our games very specifically. We train a lot different than singles players train. So I think it's just that there's a lot that goes into what you see, and there's a lot of purpose behind what you see as well.
Can you elaborate a little bit? You were mentioning like singles players who play doubles versus mm-hmm. double players. Like what does that difference look like, generally speaking?
Well, usually players who focus on their singles as their number one priority, they probably don't practice doubles very often. Maybe occasionally if they've lost singles in that tournament, and they're still in the doubles, they may do a few more doubles drills. But you know, I remember like when I was playing with Ostapenko, even if she'd lost in singles and we had doubles, sometimes we would still just practice singles. And I would practice singles too. So it's a little bit different because a predominantly doubles focused team or player will, you know, work on their doubles game. There'll be a lot of movement at the net. There'll be a lot of drills with volleys, overheads, lobs, finesse. You probably won't have as much like cross court down the line volume. Yeah, things are just a little bit more specific. And I also think, I feel like now I can get a lot done in 1 hour because I don't need to rally down the middle for 10 minutes. We can go cross, we can go line, we can come forward. There's so much that we can do in 1 hour that encompasses the entire tennis court and every single shot. So yeah, that's just a little bit of, I think, the difference.
Okay, and last one. This is a tricky one, and I'm going to make it even harder for you because I want you to say something you haven't said yet. But what this is every podcast, but what is your best advice for like the 4-0 amateur doubles player? If you can give them one thing to think about. I know. Everyone takes the long pause.
Oh my God. Can I say like one Tennessee thing and then one attitude thing?
Incredible. Give us both. Yeah, give us both.
Okay. Attitude thing, 100%, is unconditional support for your partner. Tennis, I would say pick a target and commit the hell out of it.
How do you commit? Like, it's picking a target is, I guess, somewhat tricky at times, but there's so much doubt when you're watching. How do you commit fully to a target?
You don't worry so much about what the other team is doing. Like in high-level professional doubles, we have gotten good at adapting in the last moment. So even if we've had a plan in place and something else happens outside of the plan, we can adapt. Sometimes we don't, but oftentimes we can. And it may have looked like that was the plan the whole time when it's not. However, there are times, even in my matches, where I've wanted to actually focus more on myself and how I wanted to hit the ball versus worrying about what my opponents are doing. So that's why I think when you pick a target and you commit fully, you're not worried about what the other team is doing, how they're hitting, where they're moving, where they're crossing. Because if the quality of your ball is good enough, hopefully that will take care of the point in itself. And you can just keep playing that point, you know, and keep committing to more targets. But for me, that's just been something when my brain is like mush and I can't think, just picking a target and keeping it very simple has helped me a lot.
Love that. Gabby, congratulations. 2023 was awesome for you. We're recording this in December. I'm not sure when we'll release it, but best of luck in 2024 and we'll be rooting for you.
Thanks so much.
All right. I want to thank Gabby for coming on the show. She gave us so many incredible insights. And overall, I'd say the coolest thing for me was how she really, truly knows herself and her game. She knows where she likes to return and what her targets are. She knows where she needs to be standing and what types of serves she struggles against. She knows what types of balls she likes to poach on. And she knows how to communicate with her partner. Nothing is an accident. So moving forward, see if you can learn your own game as well as Gabby knows hers. And just as a reminder, bonus episodes are now available on Apple. You can simply subscribe from your Apple Podcast app with a free trial. We've had a lot of people sign up in the past month, which is super humbling and very appreciated. And then I've also recently started a YouTube channel with longer instructional videos and clips from the podcast. So there's a link in the show notes to subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Thanks again for listening and supporting the show. I hope you just improved at tennis without even hitting a tennis ball.